Welcome to the Business of Security podcast, episode number 5. Your hosts today are Chad Beckman and Ed Snodgrass. Today, they talk with Chris Veltos, cyber risk strategist at Prudent Security. The topic is grooming future security leaders. Now, let's get to it.
The industry need to start talking about that we're not doing today.
Information technology is built on a horrible foundation. If we could sort of redo and start from the beginning, we would be so much better off.
If you don't invest in it, keep it running, it will blow up.
But you also have to be able to go in with solutions, not just problems. We have a long way to go if we're going to win this fight.
At the end of the day, educated people are really the best countermeasure against all the threats.
Okay, today we're welcoming Chris Veltos. Thank you for joining us today, Chris.
Thank you, Chad and Ed, for having me on the show.
Absolutely. We've known each other for a long time. You've been an advisor to us, and we're happy to finally have you on the show and talk to you a little bit about the business of security.
I'm excited to be here.
So with that, let's just dive right in. Let's ask the first question out of the gate. You, as a practitioner in security, can you give us a little bit of detail on your background and what it is that brought you to what you're doing today?
Sure. So I've been covering security full-time in the classroom and out for about a decade. And prior to that, I was deeply enmeshed covering software engineering as well as data communications and networking. So in the late 90s, I kept seeing more and more networking hiccups. This was the early days of denial of service attacks and eventually distributed denial of service attacks. It was also kind of a rapid growth phase for viruses. And in the mid-2000s, that's when I said, you know, all the software engineering and all this data communications and networking area is really nice, but my heart is really in the cybersecurity sphere. So I took a year off and basically retooled, went back to school, and dove right in. So it really helped that I had a good, solid understanding of C and assembly. So in terms of looking at the capabilities of malware at a very low level and understanding the, in a way, the file system forensics and the network forensics to look at the main threats and attack surface that companies had back then. And now, you know, a decade later, we're talking about such a rapid evolution of malware and such continued research and development on the part of attackers.
So based on what you're doing today, how long have you been running the cybersecurity program at the college?
So I teach full-time at Minnesota State University, Mankato, and I created the two cybersecurity courses from the ground up in 2006. I think they were launched in 2007. One is a business-focused principles of information security at the junior level for undergrads, and another one is a undergrad/grad called information warfare. And in that course, we look at cyber warfare concepts. We also look at some of the tools that attackers are likely to use simply because they're free and they're open source or modify, as well as good guys who want to be able to check the status and the health of their networks before somebody finds the easy way in. So it's very much a hands-on class, but there's also a very strong component of reflection, of taking a look at the state of cybersecurity as we are today. And both courses benefit tremendously from my Twitter feed. On Twitter, I'm known as Dr. InfoSec, and I probably tweet anywhere from 5 to 10 stories a day that I then try to weave into the class material.
So you indicated the state of cybersecurity today. What is that state, in your opinion?
Dismal. So we're not doing some of the easy things that we should be doing, and this is why we're seeing rampant epidemic of ransomware, and in some cases, companies getting breached. That should have known better because they should have had a better patch regime. And then on the attack side, you know, we're looking at attackers having more and more sophisticated tools. And on defender side, when we do have our act together, we're still very much defending by looking at the next thing or looking at the next tool and just hoping that this is going to keep us safe. So one of the things that I think is missing a lot in businesses today is a sense of security strategy.
Can you describe that for us, what you mean by security strategy?
Well, so how are we spending our money when it comes to security activities? Are we spending that wisely? Is this enough to protect us at the level of attacks today? Is this going to be enough to protect us at the level of attacks tomorrow? What companies are spending their money on, is that effective activities, effective security controls, or is it more of, well, you know, our competitor's doing this, so we should be doing this as well. Or you get a call from a vendor who promises you the moon, and you're like, well, okay, so we'll upgrade our firewall to this next-gen thing and hope that it's going to stop all of these attacks.
How do security practitioners effectively measure the effectiveness of their controls and if they're performing at a level that is expected or desired?
So that's really the key to everything we're doing today, right?
Yeah.
And if we had a good, easy answer to that, then businesses should be in trouble, basically, if they don't do that. So I'll mention two different schools of thought on this. One is to approach everything by looking internally, almost with a reflection concept, and measuring internal performance using humans on the ground that have been trained and whose opinion you trust. And then you map all this into some kind of maturity level. We've seen entities like in the financial sector, some government sectors that are continuing to push and continuing to encourage companies to use maturity as a way to measure how well we're doing. Another different aspect is the a more automated way, which is looking at tools that are running and the output of those tools, different configurations of the tools, and then be able to tap those into where the data is and try to create some kind of automated risk picture. However, I would say this is in the early stages, and I think 3 to 5 years from now, those kinds of automated capabilities are going to be better. So for now, I would say if you're starting from scratch, take a look at maturity and have a way of assessing internally your own maturity.
Oh, thank you for that. Based on what the landscape is, you indicated dismal, are we preparing higher ed in general and these higher ed programs designed to train students in cybersecurity and data protection, risk management? Are they being prepared adequately? Are the courses being offered that make them successful to be prepared for the next 5 to 10 years and beyond in the marketplace and managing cyber risk in a business?
So the question you ask is really good. And obviously, I'm a little bit biased because I created a grad degree program specifically away from the deep technical or crypto type courses, and instead focusing on security as a business issue. And so we created new courses, including information risk analysis course that looks at risks quantitatively and qualitatively. We created an information security communication course and then an information risk management course. So we created a master's degree program that's fully online specifically to go into the sweet spot of risk analysts that either are going to start as risk analysts or want to move higher up on the business side and eventually end up towards CISOs. In terms of where the education industry is in terms of preparing students in cybersecurity, it's difficult to gauge how effective we are, to be fully honest, because there's such a demand for cybersecurity professionals today that even if we do just an okay job, our students would still be able to find good jobs. However, that market is continuing to change, and we're continuing to see a lot more automation and orchestration, as well as AI, artificial intelligence, machine learning coming into the picture. And some of those, in a way, more remedial jobs might disappear or might be pushed further up. So it's important, in my opinion, for students to have not just a deep technical knowledge, unless they're going to do something like reverse engineering malware, which is very, very deep. But if they're kind of middle of the road, I would say specialize either into the deep tech or looking at the business of security.
That's a great answer, Chris, and also a great segue into our next question, which is, and I'll quantify this a little bit. So there's, you know, any number of opinions and articles and other information available out there with regard to what the next generation CISO needs to have in terms of experience and skill set and those types of things in order to really kind of be successful over the next 3 to 5 to 10 years. And a lot of those opinions, general as they are, focus on the CISO being a business executive that happens to have deep security and potentially technical expertise. And so what we'd like you to kind of expand on for us is to go a little bit beyond the generality of that opinion and maybe talk through some specific traits or characteristics or expertise that in your opinion, the next generation CISO really needs to have in order to be successful as both a business leader and a security practitioner.
So I would start by characterizing the evolution of the CISO just from the past 5 years, right? So there was a report that came out in mid to late October this year, 2017, by PwC on the global state of information security. And as part of the report, an increasing number of CISOs are reporting that they are reporting to CEOs and or boards. We're talking upwards of 20% to boards, and I think even higher than that to CEOs. And part of the chasm, in a way, is that many CISOs, if they come in from a technical background and if they haven't really pushed themselves, whether through formal education, something like an MBA or another master's degree program like the one we have, or in their own professional development in terms of looking at things much more from a business perspective and learning, you know, thinking about how do I translate these things that I know and understand as technology risk, how do I translate that when I'm speaking to a CFO or a CEO or a board director? So from my experience and having had conversations with CISOs, what I've seen is there are some CISOs that get it, and then there are some CISOs that have a ways to go. One of my CISO friends who happens to be a CISO in Switzerland said he looks at the role of a CISO as a digital trust officer. And trust takes a long time to be earned. And just being navigating the C-suite is something that is foreign for many CISOs.
I'm glad you brought that up. And that is, you know, the genesis of having this podcast is talking about that particular issue.
Now a word from our sponsor, TrustMap, the business management system for security leaders. TrustMap has been described as a solution in a couple of different ways. For example, it has been described as a GRC platform, and it's also been described as a business management platform for security teams. You see, TrustMap is designed for security teams by security teams. The genesis of TrustMap began when a CIO asked the question, "Show me the state of our security program. Where are we today and where are we going over the next 2 to 3 years? And how much is it going to take to get there?" One example of TrustMap solving real-world challenges begins with a customer in the insurance services industry that I'll refer to as David. David, like many other security program managers, struggled to coordinate all of the activities across various teams to determine the security program performance and also set priorities to improve security and manage risk over the next calendar year. Now, we'll pause there. We'll come back a little later in the podcast to learn the outcome of David's challenge using TrustMap. For now, listeners of the podcast should know that you can schedule a free trial of TrustMap. Go to trustmap.com/business. Now, let's pick up where we left off.
With existing security practitioners, how do they go about maybe sharpening their skills to navigate the business landscape? Let's say they've come from a deep technical background and they want to mature their role in the business and really be in business executive and earn their way to that spot. What advice would you give those people?
So I would encourage them to take a look at their the way they create written reports and the way they present the state of their organization's cybersecurity, and then compare that to things they're seeing from other C-suite executives. So take a look at what the CHRO, the Chief Human Resource Officer, is reporting, the CMO, the Chief Marketing Officer, is reporting, even the CPO, if they have a Chief Privacy Officer. Definitely the CFO, take a look at how they're reporting things, and how one of the things you're most likely to see is that everything that's being reported is being translated into the impact on business objectives, because this is what top leadership understands, this is what they care about, this is what they're responsible for. And that's true as well going all the way to the board. So the internal challenge for them is to take a look at what they're producing now, take a look at what the rest of the C-suite is producing, and then moving laterally to try to match that kind of output and to match, basically connect the dots between the assets, the threats, and then if those assets are compromised, the impact on the business.
So I'm gonna turn the tables a little bit here. I like to kind of ask this question to everybody. So AI and machine learning obviously is a huge discussion point, right? It's there's a lot of emerging technologies out there. VC firms as a whole are kind of getting a little bit silly with regard to throwing those investment dollars at AI firms and so forth. I think we can all agree that there's going to be a prominent place for artificial intelligence and machine learning in the security world over the next coming years. But where do you kind of see that, aside from, you know, just the automation of a lot of the operational requirements that security leaders need to have? I mean, is it going to be, and I know I'm simplifying this, Chris, but is it essentially going to come down to algorithms protecting algorithms, you know, 3 to 5 years from now? Or, you know, just kind of looking forward a little bit and speculating, how do you see AI really kind of impacting the security field as a whole?
Great question. I think AI and machine learning have great potential. I don't believe that potential has been, I mean, we've just scratched the surface for now. And so a lot of startups or companies, even well-established companies, are focusing on quick wins. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think the true benefit of AIML will come later on. But at the same time, I think we're also going to see some deep limitations. And so I think there will be a maturity of the AIML market where it's going to be more clear which areas AIML are very good at, some areas where they're okay at, and then some areas where we need a different approach. You know, looking at end user behavior analysis, we know today that there was a report that came out, again, just early November, about some research Google did in terms of phishing being such a successful way for attackers to get into to organizations today. So we know that we have a long ways to go in terms of helping our people be more skeptical of things that crosses their browsers or their Facebooks or their inbox, because the attacks are getting more sophisticated. You know, the days of being able to take a look at somebody's mistyped emails full of typos and being able to say, oh, well, this is an obvious trick, those days are long gone. When you have an attacker who's sitting inside your network, who's taking a look at all the emails floating between the CEO and the CFO, and then waits for the CEO to be away on a trip and sends a well-crafted email instructing the CFO to wire some money to a new account, it's very difficult to resist against those types of attacks. So AIML, I think, has great potential. I think we're only scratching the surface. But I also see the need for human communication-related things. And one of the questions earlier, I forgot to mention this. You know, in terms of helping businesses be better at cybersecurity, what I would encourage business leaders to do is be more skeptical. If you get your security part of your report from your CISO or your CIO, and they're saying everything is fine, and they're saying, you know, just give us more money and we'll buy this new tool, push back. Ask them, how do they know that the tools and the way the money is spent today, how do they know that this is spent effectively? And usually the answer is they won't be able to justify this.
So that really ties into managing security like a business function, I believe is what you're alluding to. Is that right?
Absolutely. So be skeptical, you know, trust but verify. We continue to hear of organizations that are deploying things to cloud-based storage, and then they realize, oops, they just leaked all kinds of sensitive data because the cloud-based storage container wasn't properly configured. And so why deploy something if you don't already have in the back of your mind the way that you know you're going to test to make sure it's configured correctly?
Or maintain that configuration over time.
So in terms of tools, you know, AI/ML is obviously a really exciting area in terms of tools, but there's tools that are popping up that will go and double check that all of your other security tools are configured correctly. And we'll let you know, we'll send you an alert if there's a change in configuration. This goes back to a process-related concept of change control board and change control management, which so many CISOs are butting heads with the technology side of the house, the CIO side of the house, just trying to get some kind of change control board in place so that changes are properly thought out, communicated, planned, and then if need be, with a rollback capability.
I'm thinking about what you said is have the business push back on the security team if they are requesting more dollars to acquire new tools and asking how is this going to improve our security posture. How does the security team in general make that determination? Because, you know, thinking about back in my career and working with some of the people we work with today, I don't know that anybody's had that question posed, and I'm not sure anybody would know how to exactly get started in evaluating and arriving at a meaningful answer to that question. Can you give us any pointers?
Sure. So I would say there's an implicit bias because whenever you ask somebody of an opinion of basically how well they're doing their job, they're going to tend to say, yes, I'm doing a good job. So this is really where I see the value of either a supporting function like internal audit, which is for the organizations that are large enough to have internal audit. They really need to leverage this. And the role and the domain of internal audit has really been, in a way, mutating to go from compliance and checklist-driven things towards continuous monitoring, continuous improvement, continuous auditing almost. And here again, the tools in that world are continuing to evolve. So from an internal perspective, I would say don't take the CISO at their word, but instead ask for another opinion from another internal entity such as internal audit or even the CFO. But that's where you need to have good checks and balances. Otherwise, I would say look at an external assessment or external audit. Bring in somebody from the outside, sit them down. It doesn't have to be technical. Just, in my opinion, just having an external reviewer or external assessor coming in and spending a day or two with the CISO and the CIO and some of the key business units that have lots of sensitive data, you can uncover all kinds of gaps.
You're hitting on a big challenge that we highlight in our presentation to customers and potential customers, and that is technology rationalization. And that's basically what you're identifying here is how do we know the technology we have is effective? Maybe we need to replace it with something else or with augment it with an additional tool set, right? And being able to show that value, roll up that information and perform those kind of performance metrics, I'll call it, or KPIs to determine our coverage as well as how this is overall reducing our risk posture. And then supporting, of course, can't forget about supporting the business in the process. Definitely not a small job.
Well, especially when something like not patching in time, if your average patch time is measured in a week or two or perhaps even a month or two, you can go from being healthy and having a good, strong cybersecurity posture to being a low-hanging fruit, as we like to call it in the field, in a matter of days, which is it's really too bad. But we continue to see people and organizations fail to do some of the basic minimum.
That rings a bell with the latest mega data breach that we've all experienced. You have some comments on the latest Equifax breach and some notes that you'd like to share with us?
Sure. So what I would say is just encourage your listeners to go take a look at the Q3 Security and Exchange Commission filings from Equifax, where they basically give shareholders some behind-the-scenes information. I will quote one sentence here. As a result of the cybersecurity incident, we're currently a party to more than 240, yes, 240 consumer class action lawsuits, as well as financial institution class action lawsuits, shareholder class action lawsuits, and so on. You know, cybersecurity today is important, so important, which is, again, why so many very top leaders, so CEOs are repositioning the CISO function, or even some boards are positioning the CISO right underneath them, basically almost along the audit committee, because cybersecurity can stop your business dead in its tracks almost overnight.
And that's interesting, too. I mean, if we look at essentially, it was a single vulnerability, really, that was the cause of this massive breach at Equifax. I mean, and I'm just pontificating here, but it would seem to me that, you know, if it's a single vulnerability that can do that much damage across your corporate network, you know, if that's not advocacy for, you know, a robust and maintainable patching process, right? The basic blocking and tackling that we all have to do within security, you know, in terms of data retention and destruction, in terms of, you know, vulnerability management and all those kind of, you know, day-to-day housekeeping type of tasks that are so critical, then I don't know what is.
You know, my initial background was in software development, and late 90s, early 2000s, there was the extreme programming movement. And as part of extreme programming, fairly quickly, a different sub-movement of software development, in this case software testing, came about called TDD, test-driven development. And this is really, in my opinion, a case where cybersecurity, that field, can learn from the field of software development in terms of testing things on a regular basis, almost having test plans by default for every tool that we launch or that we maintain in our environment. And then conducting drills, right? Because the focus has finally shifted compared to 5 years, 10 years ago. Of it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And so, not drilling your own incident responders often enough and well enough just puts you at risk in your incident response. And the other thing that we're seeing is drills that are targeted more towards top level executives. So we're talking about things like IBM's X-Force Command Center, which has a simulation environment where companies are bringing in their top leadership, and they're going through a day-long crisis dealing with the breach. And so the breach unfolds early in the morning and then keeps unfolding, and then there's distractions, sideways events, and then they get a call from a simulated call from a journalist saying, you know, I'd like to have a statement on the record. So we need to have organizations and business leaders involved and prepared.
All right, let's briefly return to our story about David. As David was seeking to understand his security program's current performance and thereby set appropriate priorities and expectations, he had to engage with team members and internal customers outside of the security team. So David launched an initial process assessment in TrustMap, aligned to his control framework and regulatory requirements. What David discovered was the ability to save time from previous efforts through the aggregation of multiple users' input and data points. So David leveraged TrustMap's analytics to tell a compelling story to executive leadership about the performance of the security program, investments required, and resources needed to achieve specified goals. The executive leadership and board of directors had the assumption that mobile security was an area already solved in the eyes of the leadership based on previous investment in a mobile device management system. However, based on the results of the program assessment in TrustMap, David could clearly articulate why mobile security was still underperforming to desired goals. In this case, it was the result of mobile application security and not device security. The analytics and planning intelligence from TrustMap supported David's story and allowed him to describe the estimated investments required and the difference between mobile device security and mobile application security to a non-technical audience. As a result, the leadership team acknowledged mobile application security as a priority, allocating funds to improve this area to achieve the desired maturity goals. TrustMap is for every leader who manages information security as a function of the business. And as a reminder, for listeners of this podcast, you should know that you can schedule a free trial of TrustMap. Go to trustmap.com/business. Now let's get back to the show.
How often do you think an organization should run an exercise, an incident response or data breach response exercise, to build that muscle memory, as they call it?
In terms of incident response exercise, internal to IT, I would say close to monthly. I mean, it doesn't have to be full-blown, full-scale event, but in a way, treat your people, your boots on the ground, a little bit more like military and do regular drills, or even first responders, right? And then in terms of the top leadership, in terms of incident response, crisis response of a major data breach, at least annually to be able to go through an exercise like this, even if it's just tabletop, and end up spending close to a full day on it. If you can bring in some lawyers or some PR experts as well to kind of give you a taste of what a real crisis would feel like, and having calls from lawyers or having to call your own lawyer. Similarly, in terms of bringing in some PR folks to help make the simulation as close to a realistic experience.
Yeah, we did this a number of times for customers, and we always know it was a success when the CIO and the CEO are exhausted and emotionally spent at the end of the day. Then we know the mission is accomplished, because that's what it's like in a real situation.
Earlier, some of the questions I mentioned, security strategy, if I were to summarize the gap that's happening today, it's in a way the inability for CISOs to articulate and keep track of a security strategy, and I have some more to say about that. And the other one is the communication piece, because we have to be better at communicating the threats, meaning on the technical side, and translate those. For anybody who speaks more than one language, you know, just think of switching on the same kind of processes in your brain to translate between tech lingo and business lingo. So communication issue and strategy issue and preparedness, really.
Is that one of the big gaps in the industry today as a cybersecurity industry, is the ability to effectively conduct that translation to the business?
In my opinion, it is. I've been writing a lot about this. I've seen a number of presentations by security leaders where, you know, very quickly into their presentation, the eyes of the audience and the leadership just glossed over, because the security leader had just dipped into very technical domain. And again, without relating this to how, so what? How does it impact the business? How is it going to hurt our bottom line?
Yeah, in another podcast that we did, we spoke about this exact subject. And at the end of the day, the simplest way to say it is everybody in the business, no matter your role, is there to make money or save money. And you highlighted that in a few of your points already today in our conversation. And I think that's what we have to remember when we are presenting and aggregating data up to align it to what the business really cares about, and how what we're doing as a security team, a security program, is impacting positively, or maybe we're falling behind in areas that need to be highlighted as well, the business, the bottom line of the business. Treat it as another investment.
Absolutely.
So again, I mean, there's a lot of literature, a lot of things out there about the talent shortage in the cybersecurity industry, both today and the projected shortage in the future. And you know, you're in a great position, Chris, to be able to, you know, kind of shape the next generation of security practitioners and leaders out there. My question is, you know, what are some of the things that you see as motivating, you know, young, talented men and women that are looking at potential careers, some incentives perhaps, that really can keep these talented individuals, you know, in the STEM field, and potentially, you know, we can utilize their experience and expertise as they gain it in the cybersecurity industry. What are some of the things that you see now that you like that motivate these individuals? And then what are some potential things that we as, you know, executives and leaders in the industry can do to make sure that, you know, we have the opportunity to really kind of bring some of this great talent into our industry?
Sure. So on the STEM students, science, technology, engineering, and math, from my own experience, what I've seen is the students get drawn to the technical and the impressive side of the tools. So being able to do a little bit of a forensic analysis with something like Wireshark, being able to crack some passwords, being able to do some low-tech social engineering recon on some targets, that gets them excited. And then you can go into some additional technical things such as, you know, network mapping, vulnerability scanning, and eventually deploying more attack-like or pen-testing-like tools like a Metasploit. So this is a tactic I've used quite successfully to get students engaged in taking my classes. So for the students that are not majoring in cybersecurity, my classes are optional, but they end up filling up semester after semester. I would want to also make the case that at the national level, NIST is making some very good progress in terms of creating cybersecurity curriculum and mapping this. My concern, in a way, with this is we continue to look at cybersecurity in a very narrow way, in a way by looking at it mainly from the STEM disciplines. And for me, cybersecurity is more like a college of business. If you look at the degree programs offered by a college of business, you're going to have some management, you're going to have some marketing, you're going to have some finance, you're going to have some accounting. So I see cybersecurity, and then when you move cybersecurity up into the corporate meeting rooms and the boardrooms, I see cyber risk as much broader of an issue. And so I would want to encourage colleges and universities and state education boards to really be flexible and to start thinking about cybersecurity out of the box in terms of a mixture of management with a little bit of technology and perhaps a little bit of psychology, perhaps even some philosophy.
Couldn't agree more. I think what you described, looking at it as a college of business, is ultimately where we need to be, both the existing workforce in security as well as the up and coming, and being able to identify those areas you highlighted, marketing and finance and obviously technology. But being able to do so is going to create a well-rounded security leadership.
One more item, which is let's not forget about the end users and the everyday persons. I'm part of a group where we call ourselves the Cyber Avengers. We published a Cyber Avengers playbook at the end of September 2017, which is available free as a PDF. But one of the things that we set as a kind of a national cybersecurity platform for the country, really, kind of a wake-up call, is we need to have a national cybersecurity curriculum. So this kind of training, this kind of mindset, and in a way almost like hardening, should be available to everybody, not because we want everybody to become a cybersecurity expert, but because we have a lot of room to grow in terms of being a little bit more skeptical than we currently are.
Absolutely. Chris, before we go, I have to ask one last question.
Yep.
And that is, if you could change anything in the industry today with regard to the cybersecurity industry, what would it be?
So if I could change anything, it'd be the penalty of not getting cybersecurity right. And the good news is I think we're heading there. You know, some of the big breaches, 2017 has been a banner year for breaches. I mean, between big data breaches, between things like ransomware and with other silly things, I think this is the last straw and we need some kind of change. And I think we're going to see some big actions, whether they come from the legal environment or from the regulation environment or a mixture of both. But that will help drive, in my opinion, a better, more engaged set of conversations between the top leaderships of the business who are going to be a little bit more have reasons to be more engaged, to avoid lawsuits or perhaps even jail time. And the folks in charge with managing cyber risk, which includes in some ways the CFO, the CIO, the CISO, obviously. But then again, if the organization is big enough, internal audit.
Do you have any advice for executives or board members that you'd like to leave them with?
Be skeptical. You know, and if you think that you're not getting the accurate picture, push back or seek some outside or second opinion.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Chris. This has been very informative. I really appreciate your perspective, and it certainly is enlightening to kind of hear what's going on in higher ed as well. So thank you again for spending time with us and for educating us.
Well, thank you for having me, and hopefully your listeners follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Infosec, DrInfoSec.
Very good. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chad. Thank you, Ed.
Thanks for listening to the Business of Security podcast. A special thanks to today's guest, Chris Veltos, cyber risk strategist at Prudent Security. Your hosts today were Chad Beckman, founder and CEO of Secure Digital Solutions, and Ed Snodgrass, chief information security officer at SDS. You can connect with Chad and Ed on LinkedIn and learn more about Secure Digital Solutions at trustsds.com. Our show was produced by Dan Rollins with LiveWire Films. You can find Dan on LinkedIn and learn more about LiveWire Films at livewirefilms.com. Check out our next podcast episode with Sharon Smith, executive consultant with C-Suite Results. The topic is, are we achieving unparalleled excellence? You've been listening to the Business of Security podcast, and that's a wrap.